The Apostle Paul was a brilliant theologian. He was a tenacious missionary. He was an amazing administrator. He's the one, really, who put structure to our Christian faith. Jesus came proclaiming the gospel message. Jesus came inviting us to follow him along the way. But Paul is the one who came and gave structure to it, theology to it, and expanded it and spread it all around the Mediterranean world at that time. Brilliant, brilliant man. All that is true. But at the heart of who Paul was, in his soul, at the center of his very being, he's just a preacher. He's just a preacher. He's got one message. He's got a one-string guitar that he plays. He's got one sermon that he preaches. And it's a simple idea that God has reconciled God's self to you. You and I have been invited. The world has been invited to become something new, to become a new creation, a new being, a new one, a new person. The driving influence in all of his theological work, his missionary zeal, and the rest was to spread God's singular wish to be reconciled to us so that we too might have new life. Paul believes that we've seen in Jesus something of what it means to be alive in God. God has come to the world and encountered death, and death was not the end. Death was not the final word spoken. We're therefore invited to not live in fear of death, but to receive the life that God gives us even now, to live fully alive today. Paul's message, though, is not about some far-off future. It's not about getting good enough or righteous enough or okay enough to get into heaven. Never is Paul's message about, here's how you can get your ticket stamped for heaven. One per person, please. No. He wants us to live now as though we've already experienced something of what heaven will be when that day finally comes. It's not about the far future. It's about the present reality. This moment. Paul's calling the church in Corinth to reconcile themselves to God. This reconciliation is then mirrored in our willingness and our ability to reconcile ourselves to each other, to those relationships that I mentioned during the prayer time that may be broken. Now, I know that reconciliation is not exactly a word we use all the time, so here's a couple of definitions. To be reconciled is to settle differences, or to be reconciled is to make peace with the other. So take a moment with me, would you please? Consider your life. I want you to think of one, just one. One person that you were in relationship with at one time and are broken now. A parent, child, a brother, a sister, a neighbor, a friend, a co-worker, someone. Is there someone that you've been thinking to yourself, I should send her a text. I should write him a note. I should drop her a card. Maybe I could just pick up my phone and call them. You know, I heard a psychologist once talking about things like this, and he said, the only way to stop bad behavior is to stop. And the only way to do something right is to do it. Sometimes it's just that simple, isn't it? It's just that simple, that basic, that clear. Write a letter, send a card, a Facebook message, a messenger pigeon, whatever works. Maybe it's that simple. You know, the Eagles have a song from back in the 70s called Already Gone. There's a line at the end that says, so oftentimes it happens that we live our lives in chains when we never realize we already have the key. So oftentimes it happens that we live our lives in chains. Chains named anger, frustration, revenge, a desire to win, to get it right, to prove the other wrong, to put them down. Chains that hold us back, that lock us up, never realizing that we already have the key. Are you tired of those chains of anger and revenge and frustration? Maybe it's time. Maybe it's time to take the simple route. And another definition of this word reconciliation says to kiss and make up. Kind of like that one. When I was a little boy, my mom would make us siblings kiss and make up anytime we got into a fight. She was rarely worried about who was right and who was wrong because most of the time, well, my sisters and brother will tell you, I was wrong most of the time. But most of the time, really, both of us were wrong. There was some silly thing that was causing us to fight. My mom would say, Glenn, you go to your sister Jerry, give her a kiss on the cheek, and you tell her you're sorry. Jerry, give Glenn a kiss on the cheek and tell him you're sorry. Now go and do it. No, I meant do it now. Go and do it. And we would do it. It would be the quickest kiss in the history of humankind, you know, just this quick little kiss. Now, my mom never really worried, like I said, about who's right. What she wanted was for us to reconnect with each other. There's something, isn't there, about pressing your cheek on the cheek of another? Maybe exchanging a brief kiss that reminds us that we're not really all that different. Even in our anger, our frustration, and our desire for revenge, really, ultimately, none of us are all that different, not in the long run. Not at all. Maybe I should call President Obama. I don't have his number, but I might try to find it. Give him a phone call and say, you know, Mr. President, my mom would be great at helping us to create relationships between American Christians and American Muslims. It seems like we get angry with each other. We're unable to talk. My mom can work this out. She'll make us kiss each other first. She'll make that happen. And then we'll find really that we're not all that different. A couple of years ago, my friend Art Nemetoff, who's the senior rabbi at Congregation B'nai Yehuda down in South Johnson County, invited me to preach in his pulpit. Julie and I went there on a Friday night for their Shabbat services, and we sat down among the congregation. It was an honor to be there. I was thrilled to share a word of good news with the folks there. Well, we sat down and we opened the worship book, and we found that most of it was in Hebrew. We should not have been surprised, but most of it was. I took Hebrew in school, learned it over a year, but 30 years later, I was having trouble keeping up. I couldn't keep up at all. In fact, we were about three pages behind when this sweet man sitting next to Julie leaned in real close to her. His shoulder was pressing on hers. He put his finger down on the book where we were, and he showed her where we were in the readings and then where we were in the music. Now, most of the time, we couldn't read the words. We really didn't understand. When it came time to turn the page, though, he would quickly and gently turn the page for her and then catch up again. Here's where we are. I got to tell you, his shoulder pressing on hers, his hand sweetly guiding us through the worship, was in and of itself an act of worship. The prayers were beautiful. The songs were amazing. I love Art's style and the way he leads his congregation. But that simple leaning close to the other was all by itself an image of worship. Well, as the time came for me to preach, Art invited me to the pulpit. And as I walked up to their pulpit, he stood up on his tiptoes. He's only about 5'7", 5'8", and he pulled me down and he gave me a kiss right on the cheek. It was a surprise. I wasn't expecting that to happen, but I shouldn't have been surprised. You might recall that on the 10th anniversary of 9/11, it was a Sunday, September 11th. It was a Sunday here when I invited my friend Art to bring a good word to us in this pulpit. I also invited my friend Ahmed El Sharif, a Muslim imam, to come and speak to us with a word of hope. The three of us met in my office at about 10:45. When Art and Ahmed arrived at almost the same time, they immediately embraced each other and exchanged a double kiss. You know, I've got to tell you, there's something hopeful about that simple act. It was a beautiful scene. Maybe some of you were there 5 years ago, when we stood, the three of us stood, a Christian pastor, a Muslim imam, and a Jewish rabbi, stood shoulder to shoulder in the worship of God. Now, do I disagree with some of the things that my friend Ahmed believes politically and theologically and spiritually? You're darn right I do, and he disagrees with me. Same thing is true about Art, but you know what? Those disagreements begin to fade away when we can stand shoulder to shoulder and recognize that together we are the children of the one God. Reconciliation sounds like a very simple thing to do, and it may actually be the one thing our world needs more than anything else. Maybe that's why when Paul wrote to the church in Corinth, this very letter, that at the end of it, he instructed them to greet each other. Christians, greet each other with a holy kiss. Paul knew then what we know now, that sense of intimacy, that willingness to become close to the other invites us into a relationship between equals. Greet each other with a holy kiss. It's an invitation to friendship, to intimacy, to reconciliation. Reconciliation is also about naming the wrongs while finding the courage to begin again. Maybe even to turn around or to repent. I love the prophet Hosea. I'm sure that the apostle Paul read Hosea. He had a similar idea in mind. Hosea wrote to the people of Israel, "Return, Israel, to the Lord your God, for you have stumbled because of your sin." It's a simple message and yet a very clear one. Return, come back, stop what you're doing, begin again. You're going the wrong way. Turn around. Your sin, your mistakes, your bad choices, your failure to be reconciled to the other has ruined your lives. I even found one Protestant Christian translation that said, "Your naughtiness has gotten you in trouble." Your naughtiness has gotten you in trouble. Nonetheless, the instruction, as I said, is simple, but it's not always easy to hear or understand, is it? Maybe you've seen the movie Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. Raise your hand. Have you seen that Steve Martin movie? John Candy, Steve Martin, came out several years ago. Kind of replays every year around Thanksgiving. One of my favorite films of all time. There's a scene late in the movie. They've been on a plane together. John Candy is this obnoxious, kind of crazy, wild guy. And Steve Martin is this perfectly put together business person, obviously very successful. They end up on a plane together. They end up on a train. It's a couple of days of travel. It's hectic. It's strange. They finally rent a car together. They're very tired. They're driving home to Chicago. They're trying to get to Chicago for their Thanksgiving celebration when Steve Martin in the passenger seat falls asleep. John Candy, who's driving, he too falls asleep. He loses control of the car. It spins around, and pretty soon it goes through the divide, and it's in the other way, but it's now going the wrong way against traffic. And they're just driving against traffic, the wrong direction. Candy wakes up, but he doesn't know that they're driving the wrong way because there's no traffic at the moment. So he just keeps driving along. Another car, going the right way on the other side of the freeway, pulls up next to them. They roll down their window, and they start screaming, "You're going the wrong way." And Steve Martin and John Candy are looking at them going, "Hey, you're drunk, aren't you? You're crazy, whatever." And they just kind of laugh at him and smile at him and wave at him. They say again, "You're going the wrong way." And they say, "You guys are crazy. Leave us alone." And then Martin and Candy both look, and there are the headlights of two semi-truck trailers coming right at them. And then they turn and face each other and say, "We're going the wrong way." Now, they survive. Don't worry. It's a happy ending. But sometimes that's how it is in life, isn't it? Sometimes it takes a trailer tractor full of your own stuff to come at you, to make you realize, to make me realize, to make us realize that we're going the wrong way. And it's time to repent, to stop, to turn around, to go a new direction. Sometimes, honestly, really, it's that simple. And like I said, of course, that's part of the problem. We don't always want to look where we are or where we're going, especially when we convince ourselves that these things really are not that big of a deal. Paul says, "You are a new creation. Now go live like it. Now go act like it really matters. Let your life show that." Our stewardship campaign this year is, as Matt and Valerie said so beautifully this morning, inspired by the song "My Life Flows On," especially the words from the chorus, which ask the beautiful question, "How can I keep from singing?" You know, stewardship in the church, again, as Matt and Valerie noted, is often focused on the receiving of your pledges and your gifts. The finance committee and the stewardship committees count all these pledges up. They add up all the money that we can expect for the year, and then they put together a budget. It's really a very careful and thoughtful and thorough process, I can assure you. But stewardship is so much more than that. It's the stewardship of our building and grounds. It's the stewardship of the way we live as people of Christian faith. It's the stewardship of our relationships with each other. It implies a taking care of all that we live and do. To be a good steward is one who works on reconciliation. To be a good steward is one who is willing to listen to your husband, to your wife, to your friend, to your neighbor, to one maybe even who is angry with you. To be a good steward is to listen. Yesterday in this sanctuary, the very, very full house, we said goodbye to our dear, sweet friend, Sue DeWeese. Many of you, I'm sure, were there yesterday. They were married for almost 70 years, 69 years together. Long, amazing, wonderful couple. Now, like any couple, Max will tell you, they had their moments. I mean, 70 years, there's going to be a couple along the way, right? When Max and I were planning the service, I asked him, what was the one thing? Was there any one thing that you would point to that was the success of your marriage, the way you were able to live together for 70 years? I mean, my goodness, Max, I said, I'm in trouble after 7 days. You went through 70 years. This is incredible. How did you manage that? And he said two words, yes, ma'am. We laugh, certainly. But I tell you this, at the heart of who they were as a couple, who they are as a couple, there was this sense, this great sense, to choose to make every day their married lives. Oh, were there fights and disagreements? 70 years, yeah, there's going to be a few. But even in those moments, they made a choice to live in love with the other. I cannot tell you how many times I saw this rough, tough, gruff old Marine sitting by his wife, holding her hand as she went through another procedure and another surgery and another worrisome visit to the hospital. I can't tell you how many times, and many of you too saw this, where he just sat there holding her hand, making sure she knew that she was loved. It's that simple. Earlier in one of Paul's letters to the church in Corinth, he gave them some pretty strict instructions on how to live with this love with each other and why it matters. This is the Glenn Miles, the GMV, the Glenn Miles version that I'm going to give you. But he basically said to them, you may have more money than anyone else you know, but if you have more money than all the whole world and you don't have love, then you might as well be broke. He basically said to them, you might have the finest home in the country, but if you are without love, you might as well be homeless. You might have more education and knowledge than anybody else that you know, but if you don't love, you are ignorant. He was kind of fired up when he was writing those words. I know we read them at weddings, but he was really getting after them in that moment. If there is no love between you, whatever you have is nothing. It's through the power of God's love. It's through the power of the love that we share with the other that we are made a new creation. Are you willing to let God's love guide you and your life?